Hello. Thanks for joining another podcast here from Collected Miscellany. My name is Kevin Holtzberry, and today we are talking with Joseph Bottom, the author of An Anxious Age, The Post-Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of America. Mr. Bottom is one of the nation's most widely published and influential essayists, a best-selling writer of Kindle e-books, and with work published in journals from The Atlantic to The Wall Street Journal and The Washington Post. Bottom is the former literary editor of the Weekly Standard and editor-in-chief of First Things. He holds a Ph.D. in medieval philosophy and has done television commentary from programs ranging from NBC's Meet the Press to PBS NewsHour. The author of two volumes of poetry and a writer of short story and song lyrics, Mr. Bottom lives with his family in the Black Hills of South Dakota, from which he joins us to talk about his book, again the title, An Anxious Age, The Post-Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of America.
So without further ado, let's start the conversation.
The first thing I wanted to ask you is, it seems like a pretty audacious claim that you make, or the book makes, the most significant fact about modern American Protestantism, the most significant and underappreciated fact about all of contemporary America, is the collapse of the mainline Protestant churches over the last 50 years. That seems like a pretty big claim.
Yeah, it was deliberately provocative. And yet, I don't think I have understated the matter. Tocqueville, when he came to America in the 1830s, traveled along the Erie Canal, and he saw what he called the undivided current of America's Protestant churches, each of whom denounced and fought against the doctrines of the others, and yet somehow they combined into this undivided current of manners and morals in the nation. And lo and behold, as you begin to look at American history through that Tocquevillian lens, picked up, say, by Christopher Lash, who demanded that we need a revisionist history of America that understands the extent to which this nation has lived off of the patrimony, the investment into Christian religion of Western civilization. And when you take those kinds of insights and construct from them a lens through which to view American history, you start to see the extent to which this really was, and to some degree remains, a deeply Protestant country. And so everyone knows, I mean, it's no secret that the mainline Protestant churches have been collapsing, the central current of this undivided river. I call it our cultural Mississippi that runs through the American landscape. And everyone knows that these mainline churches are collapsing. I mean, it's no secret that their numbers have decayed in the way that they have. The Disciples of Christ were once 1 or 2% of the American population. They were one of the founding denominations of the National Council of Churches. And today there are fewer than 600,000 of them left. The average age of a Congregationalist in the United Church of Christ is about 63. These denominations are collapsing. And yet no one seems to remark or ask the question, what happens to America when one of the central props of the American experiment falls apart?
Well, I thought the reason that that was all collapsing was because we were entering a new age of science and reason and getting beyond superstition of religion. But if I understand your argument correctly, it's not so clear-cut. There's still significant religious undertones, but we don't recognize them in the way that we would recognize modern Protestantism. How can you unpack that a little
exactly
bit?
Right. Yeah, I think that's exactly right. What's happened is one of the reviewers in The Week reviewed this new book of mine, An Anxious Age, and he phrased it in a way that made me jealous, that I wish that I had used in the book. He said, why did we imagine that the spiritual anxieties of an entire enormous class of Americans would disappear or go away the day they stopped going to church? And I think that's a really nice way to put it. All of these spiritual anxieties that shape a culture that Max Weber taught us to look for sociologically, have been set free by the collapse of these churches to find new homes, particularly in politics. And I say in the book that, you know, we live in what anyone else besides our own deluded selves would understand as a spiritual age, when, for example, we cannot see our political enemies as merely mistaken. We have to see them as evil.
Interesting the way you sort of correlate the religious feelings of believers with salvation, and this I don't know how you sort of transferred belief in salvation. What do these post-Protestant people see themselves? How do they see themselves as being saved? How does this religious expression come out in public life when there is no actual theological, I assume theological belief beneath that?
Well, I think there is some theology here, and we'll get to that. But, you know, what spiritual anxiety is about, as Max Weber described it in his seminal work, The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism, it's a demand not merely that we be saved, but that we know that we're saved, that we have certainty in our salvation. In the hands of these post-Protestants that I call the poster children, it manifests itself as a desperate hunger to know that you're a good person. And typically, you know you're a good person because you affirm the good propositions in American society. You know that you're a good person because you're against bigotry. You know that you're a good person because you are against militarism, and so on. And as you don't actually have to do anything, any particular action, because sin through the social gospel movement in the last years of the American mainline Protestant experience got redefined as no longer personal sin, but social sin. And you know you're a good person because you're not like those terrible people of the past who were all slave-owning oppressors of women. You know you're a good person because you reject them. And that doesn't take anything except what Walter Rauschenbusch, the great preacher of the social gospel movement, called having a redeemed personality. You know that you're saved, and you recognize others who are saved in this way because they have the right attitudes about our social condition.
Talk a little bit about your approach to writing the book. Again, the title, An Anxious Age, The Post-Protestant Ethic and Spirit of America. Because I found it interesting, you seem to be pushing back a little bit, too, in saying that sociology and intellectual history and an understanding of religion, many of these subjects and topics that academics and academia has left behind, are really important to understanding where we're at and where we're going. And it seems to me you're trying to bring back a sort of way of understanding the world that academia and maybe popular culture has tried to put behind us. Is that an accurate description of some of your perspective?
Yeah, of some of it. I think there's a deliberate and, attempt to push back on the analysis of American culture that's been undertaken in academia and outside of it for many years, which has all been consciously or unconsciously influenced by Karl Marx and the idea that somehow every explanation has to be an economic explanation. Every explanation has to have a material foundation somehow. Every explanation of, say, the class of elites, which have been analyzed from James Burnham to Daniel Bell to Christopher Lash. Everybody keeps looking at this class of America and trying to understand it. And I say, you know, they give good explanations, but ultimately unsatisfying ones, because the foundations of their explanations are all necessarily material. It's about economics. It's about defining a new class that wants to, as Daniel Bell put it. It's always about, you know, the Marxist material of history. And I say we should go back to Weber instead, to Max Weber, and say that culture actually is formed by, at least as much by, its spiritual concerns. And in our case, we have this huge cultural investment in believing that the elite class are good people. They need to understand themselves in that way. And, you know, I take the very recent ousting of Mozilla's co-founder, Brendan Eich, as a great example of this, you know, new post-Protestant class behaving like a religion.
He had stepped outside the prescribed theological bounds and so had to be kicked out, I guess.
Right. For the sin of insufficient atonement.
Well, tell me a little bit about another thing I found fascinating is there seems to be this gap in our cultural and historical understanding. And it really was fascinating that you found a connection point in the Erie Canal. What should Americans understand about the Erie Canal and that region of America that helps explain where we are today? Why is the Erie Canal important?
You know, Kevin, I'm so glad you picked that up, because I think most of the reviewers have missed it. One of the arguments I make is that, let me put it this way, probably the single most revisionist thing I'm doing in this book is saying Boston is beside the point. Every book ever written in the discipline of American studies starts with the Puritans and keeps going with the idea of the Puritans. And I say religious history in the United States in the 19th century was not actually happening in Boston. Boston controlled the mechanisms of fame, it's true enough, but real religious history was happening in upstate New York. And over again, as you pull at a thread of American religious history, you find that it starts in the burned-over district of upstate New York. And there's a way in which, in fact, we could read the last presidential election as a battle between two sides of, or two groups that came out of upstate New York, the Mormons on the one side and the social gospel movement on the other. It's a way of sort of understanding how all these threads run back to just this roiling craziness of upstate New York in the 19th century.
Talk a little bit, too, about the characters that you described there in the social gospel, Walter Rauschenbusch and those figures. It seems like a much bigger figure than maybe most people understand him to be, somebody who really was a prefiguring and had a big impact on our culture, but yet someone probably, I would say 99.9% of Americans wouldn't have a clue who he was.
Yeah, I that's exactly the argument I make. I mean, I say he's the most significant American intellectual figure since the Civil War, but I'm having a little fun doing that, making that kind of loud claim, because later on I say he's more a sign of the age than he is the former of the age. He's not the man who put these, you know, who made this happen. He's just the man who took what was in the air and kind of made it most visible. He's like a weather vane, instead of being, you know, the tunnel that directs the wind. Still, even as a sign of the age, he's this dominant figure whose vocabulary and understandings of the need to switch the concept of sin from a personal concept to a social one becomes overwhelmingly the path of America.
Well, tell me a little bit about how did he sort of capture what was in the air and bring it to the popular culture? And then where did it get handed off to? How did it become sort of this part of our air, maybe that we don't even realize we've breathed in and accepted?
Well, what Walter Rauschenbusch does is he writes with Christianity, he writes about Christianity in a way that simply captures the progressive side of the high American liberal Protestant churches. Fosdick in New York picks it up, and John D. Rockefeller builds for Fosdick that church that becomes the flagship on Riverside Drive of the social gospel movement. And increasingly, people began to see themselves as connected across denominations. If you were a liberal, progressive Congregationalist, you felt like you had more in common with a liberal, progressive Presbyterian than you did with the non-liberal people in your own Presbyterian or your own Congregationalist denomination. And that happened on the other side, too. The key figure to oppose Rauschenbusch is John Gresham Machen, who founds Westminster Seminary, leaves Princeton in a huff, Princeton Divinity School, founds Westminster, and it becomes the flagship for the people who we would later call evangelicals, who at the time were called fundamentalists. Now, in the 1970s, fundamentalists would get picked up as a pejorative term. But back in the 1920s, it's understood, it's the name that they gave themselves, as the people who devoted to the fundamentals of Christianity instead of the people who were redefining sin as social rather than personal.
So we have the poster children who, I guess, slowly following in this path of the social gospel, drop the gospel and keep the social. And they sort of are the replacement for the mainline Protestants. You talk about another group of people who seemed maybe poised to take up the mantle, the Catholic Church, who would seem would have the ability to take up this mantle that the mainline Protestants have. What happened, and why didn't it work?
I think that that's the second great question of the last 50 years in America. If the first question is, why did the mainline Protestant churches collapse and what happened to the people who used to go belong to them? The second question is, why didn't Catholicism take its place? Catholicism, after all, was and remains the largest Christian denomination in America. It had this long history of intense and complex theology and philosophical thought behind it, especially in recent decades, about how to relate to a democracy and how to speak a public moral voice. So why didn't it just sort of step in and prop up the American experiment in the way that the mainline Protestant churches had done? And there were a lot of people in those days writing, looking for this to happen. Michael Novak writes The Spirit of Democratic Capitalism, which is essentially a plea for America to substitute Catholicism for what's happening to the Protestant churches. Richard John Newhouse is involved in this. This was called by its proponents the John Courtney Murray Project, after the Catholic writer, Catholic American, who had been an advisor at Vatican II. And lots of us worked on this project, particularly in the form of it that we sometimes called Evangelicals and Catholics Together. And I was at all those meetings with Chuck Colson and Richard Land from the Southern Baptist Convention and Richard John Newhouse and Cardinal Avery Dulles. And this project was aiming at substituting Catholicism, Catholic moral vocabulary, a non-anti-Catholic evangelical understanding, to draw out of that combination some moral public vocabulary that could substitute for the lost moral public vocabulary that the Protestant churches once spoke. It succeeded to some degree. I joked in the pages of the Weekly Standard that after the Republican victories in the 2010 congressional elections, the average new member, the typical new member of Congress, was a Texas businessman who went to an evangelical church and, when he opened his mouth, spoke in the language of Catholic social teaching about dignity of the person, about just war theory, and all the rest of it. But in many other ways, it failed. And the election of 2008 and 2012, those two elections, I think simply showed that this project was not going to be able to count on Catholic votes, because Catholics had simply become indistinguishable from every other voter in America, and it wasn't going to be able to count on evangelical votes either, because the evangelicals are a force of the past rather than of the future.
Well, let's unpack two parts of that. The one part I wanted to have you speak to a little bit, how do you see the Catholicism of the past with its vibrant parish life and its sort of ethnic and cultural connections to communities? It seems like you're arguing to a certain extent the loss of that Catholicism meant the lack of foundation for this sort of intellectual, political, public-like Catholicism. Did that play a role in that, that with the scandals and everything, the sort of Catholic life could not support the intellectual arguments of the Catholic in the public sphere?
Well, certainly, you know, Catholicism ceased to be an ethnic force in America. Now, the Hispanics complicate this to some degree, but the old ethnic communities of the American cities simply disappeared. Some of it by a fading tribal identity, some of it by, a fading Catholic identity, some of it by the melting pot that is the call across the crabgrass frontier into suburbia. But regardless, the great ethnic voting blocks that the Catholics had relied on up through the election of John F. Kennedy gradually disappeared. And as we lost them, Catholicism increasingly had to rely on, as a political force, more and more had to rely upon its public vocabulary, the intellectual power of its public vocabulary, and its prestige as a social force through figures like John Paul II with his campaign against communism, and Mother Teresa with her charitable work. Once the priest scandals broke, which was mostly about stuff that had happened in the 1970s, but the story breaks in 2001, 2002. And when that breaks, the prestige part of this Catholic presence in public square simply disappeared overnight. That left merely the intellectual coherence of this Catholic public moral vocabulary, which, as I said, many evangelicals learned to speak. It was nice, it was interesting, it played a very interesting role in American public life during those years, but it was not enough by itself to carry the day.